Hi there, it's Brian Stelter here. This is my last episode hosting Apple News in Conversation. And up next in the host seat is Julia Carpenter, formerly of the Wall Street Journal. She'll be focusing her episodes around money and personal finance. And she has a question for you. Has a traumatic event impacted your relationship with money? Maybe you lost your job during the 2008 financial crisis, or around the start of the pandemic. Or maybe you've been evicted in the past, or been through a divorce where money was a sticking point. How has an event like that changed the way you think about and manage your finances? If you have a story about this, we want to hear it. Use your iPhone's Voice Memos app to record yourself. Tell us your name, where you're from, your experience, and how it's affected you. And please try to keep it to about a minute or so. You can send it to us at applenewstoday@apple.com. Again, that's applenewstoday@apple.com. And we might include your story on the show. Thanks. This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Brian Stelter, filling in for Shamita Basu. Today, Ezra Klein's 5 ideas for making American politics work better. America is one of the world's greatest democracies. Our Constitution is the longest surviving written charter of government in the world. We have a system of checks and balances that supports free and fair elections and that protects people's rights and freedoms like speech, religion, and assembly. But the system is far from perfect, and many Americans are far from satisfied with it. A recent Pew Research survey found that 7 in 10 Americans, 72%, feel that our political system is not working well.
Sometimes you look at a poll like that and you're like, who's the 28%? Who's like, you know what? What this is serving up is what I was hoping for.
That is Ezra Klein. He's an opinion columnist for the New York Times, host of the podcast The Ezra Klein Show, and author of the book Why We're Polarized.
I think it would be very strange to look at American politics in the year of one's Lord, 2024, and say, we nailed this. No changes needed. No notes.
There is a lot about our system that has people feeling disillusioned. Like the fact that presidential elections often come down to a few thousand people in a handful of swing states. And that so many lawmakers are decades older than the average American. And that billions of dollars in dark money gives the super rich an outsized influence in elections. That is why I wanted to call up Ezra. He's one of the top thinkers and writers on U.S. politics today. So I wanted to talk to him about some concrete ways we could make this system better.
We've never had in American politics a period of time where the two parties were as competitive, where the presidency and Congress changed hands as often as in recent decades. Oh. So you have a very, very close competition between the two sides. And at the same time, you have a tremendous amount of partisan rancor between them and a real fight for inches. And that is a system in which it is very hard to get really anything through, but particularly structural reforms, because whichever side benefits from a structural inequity, in this case, the Republicans benefit from most of the minoritarian protections or dimensions of our system, are not going to want it to change. So as we get more polarized and need a system that reflects polarization better and balances polarization better, the very fact of that polarization makes it harder to do anything to reform the system. Mm. I mean, this is often the paradox of political reform. When it is most needed, it is least possible. Because if you had the kind of agreement and bipartisan bonhomie that would make political reform something you can imagine passing, it would actually in many ways be less urgent that it passes.
Mm.
The other thing I would say is that as we've become further and further away in time from the founding, we have given the founders and the document they wrote, the Constitution, more of a mythic or even demigod status. If you go back to early American history, people are constantly trying to change the Constitution and in fact doing so, right? There's no view in 1821 that we nailed the Constitution and don't need to ever edit it ever again. Really, since the Equal Rights Amendment failed, there's not been any serious effort to amend the Constitution. And I do think that also reflects this kind of ascension into mythological status of the founding generation and the Constitution itself that earlier eras in American life did not share, in part because they were closer, right? They knew that previous Americans were just like them trying to figure it out.
Oh, interesting. I mean, that explains why for the first 125 years after the Constitution was ratified, the size of the House grew steadily. 59, then all the way to 435. Then it stopped growing, right? It was restricted by a 1929 law to the current 435 members. Even though the country's population keeps growing and growing and growing, we are sticking with what we've had for our lifetimes.
Yeah, we like to call America a great experiment, but we have lost any sense of experimentation.
So let's dive into our five things that you'd want to change about the American system today. The first one you identified was eliminating the Electoral College. I think a lot of people would agree with you here, but why is this a change that's needed right now?
I mean, it's been needed for a long time, but what I'll say about it right now is the Electoral College has begun in a way that has not been true at any other point in American history, quite routinely deciding elections, or quite routinely nearly deciding elections. Mm. So it decided the election in 2000. It decided the election in 2016. We've never had two elections so near to each other decided by the Electoral College. It very easily could have decided the election in 2020. It very easily could have decided in 2024. So then you have to ask, do we want the Electoral College deciding the election? What the Electoral College was supposed to do was create a check of elites on the passions of the mob. So the founders were very skeptical of democracy. What they created was not a democracy. Very few people were actually allowed to vote. But they were even worried that those who were allowed to vote would be subject to the appeals and passions of demagogues. And so they wanted a check of people like them who would have unusual power, would be appointed by legislatures, and would be able to say, hey, public, semi-public, part of the public, you have elected this person you should not have elected, and we are not going to allow that. What the Electoral College was supposed to do, to put it bluntly, was stop somebody like Donald Trump from getting power. The fact that it now operates as a somewhat random warping of the popular vote, such that somebody like Donald Trump can get power despite losing the popular vote, is bad. By the way, the Electoral College does not always advantage Republicans. In 2012, to the extent anyone had an advantage in it, it was Obama. The Electoral College, because of the places Obama was winning, would have, and in fact did, although not in a way that decided the election, amplify the votes Democrats had. But from a very direct, I think just like raw political perspective, we want the vote to represent the popular vote. Like that has legitimacy to it. That is the, when we are talking about somebody winning the presidency, we are talking about them winning the nation, right? So you want the thing, the closest thing you can find to what represents the nation, or at least the voting nation, to be represented. That's very obviously the popular vote.
Well, there is a bit of momentum to change this. It's something called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. So far, 16 states and D.C. have signed on. It's an agreement where states would award all of their electoral votes to whichever presidential candidate wins the popular vote nationwide. But in order for this compact to take effect, more states would have to join. So what do you think, Ezra? Is this going anywhere?
I mean, it is if enough states decide they want to join. Right now, it does not seem like that has any pathway to enough states joining it, precisely because Republicans feel the Electoral College benefits them. I mean, I don't know. Maybe if Joe Biden, maybe if in 2024, Joe Biden loses by 2 million votes in the popular vote, but wins the Electoral College because he wins Wisconsin and he wins Pennsylvania and he wins Arizona, Republican states will begin to feel differently about this, and some of them will join the compact. That would be great from my perspective, because I would like to see the Electoral College gone, but I'm not holding my breath. And I also hope we don't have a weird Electoral College outcome.
All right, let's move to the next change you'd like to see, abolishing the filibuster. This is the Senate rule that requires a 60-vote supermajority for legislation to proceed from debate to a final vote. It makes it very hard, actually nearly impossible, to pass anything in the Senate if one party only has a slim majority. So, Ezra, why does eliminating this procedural rule make your list?
This is my white whale. I care about this more than I care about almost anything else in changing the system. The filibuster is complicated. First, it is not anything we created in the Constitution. It was not created at the founding of the Congress. As best we understand it, the filibuster was created accidentally. For most of American history, the filibuster was very rarely used. And if you know, it would be used 2 to 3 times per year. In that period, when it was used only a couple of times per year, it's primarily used for a very sordid purpose, which was blocking civil rights bills. The filibuster was deployed by the Southern Dixiecrat faction to block things like anti-lynching laws. So that is what the filibuster's sterling history is. Then it sort of begins to creep up as polarization increases. And as polarization begins to spike and the parties become very different from each other, it becomes almost constantly used. So functionally, everything that can be filibustered now is filibustered. The theory of the filibuster is a couple things. But when you hear about it in sort of folk theorizing about it, right, the way it's talked about in our political system, the argument is that, well, you know, the great thing about the filibuster is it encourages compromise. Now, one thing I would just say is when you say in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s, 2020s, which is a time period in which we're talking about, does it feel to anybody else like American politics is becoming really compromise-oriented? Like we're doing a great job in the Senate agreeing on bills together. And of course not. So one, we know we can look at it and say this is not encouraging compromise. And the reason it's not encouraging compromise is that if you're a member of the U.S. Senate and you can kill a bill, that might be better from your perspective or certainly from your party's perspective than kind of agreeing to a compromise on the bill. If you cannot kill the bill, right, if you are not powerful enough to stop the bill from happening, well, then maybe you want to participate in the legislative process, bring something home to constituencies back home,
right,
have your ideas come in. In a world where you can block everything or a lot of things and try to make the majority a failure such that you can then run against them in the next election as a kind of do-nothing, failed, you know, governing coalition, you probably want to do that. So that's one reason you might want to get rid of it. Another reason is that there actually is a way to get around the filibuster. It's something called the budget reconciliation process. And I, like, forgive me, like, I don't like explaining this and nobody likes hearing about it. But budget reconciliation is a speedway past the filibuster created, I think, again in the 70s.
And this is basically the only way anything gets done now.
Yeah. So it reconciles budgetary bills. But what they realize is that, again, complicated procedural rules here, but you can actually call a lot of things a budgetary bill as long as they spend money. So what this means is that certain kinds of things can be jammed into these huge budget reconciliation bills. That's how, say, the Inflation Reduction Act was passed. But, a lot of things cannot be. And so that creates this weird pressure in American politics, one, to put lots of pieces of legislation into one, because you can only pass between one and three, depending on how you think about it, budget reconciliation bills a year. So you have these huge Christmas tree bills where everything is in one package, as opposed to sort of looking at things individually. Two, it creates a huge pressure to do things that can be done through raising and lowering spending or taxes, because of those things can be classified as budgetary, but you can't do things that change regulations. The whole thing is just ridiculous. It's bad for actually creating compromise. It creates a lot of gridlock. It makes the two sides less likely to collaborate. It makes it so the public doesn't get what they vote for. It makes it so the whole system is unable to revisit old bills and change them and update them and modernize them. You would never run anything else like this. You notice the House does not create a filibuster because that would be stupid. Like, we just shouldn't have it.
And what would be the practical impact? What would voters notice differently?
Imagine Democrats win in 2024 and they win 52 seats in the Senate, which is very unlikely because the Senate map is very bad for them, but hypothetically. And they decide, listen, we ran and won on protecting abortion rights. It would be a betrayal of our voters to do nothing on that. So they could, with 51 votes, get rid of the filibuster. And then the thing the voters would notice is that they would do the thing they promised and at least presumably pass a bill protecting some set of abortion rights. The things that voters would notice is that more legislation would pass that is closer to what the parties have promised. And they might not always like that, right? I mean, everybody always says, look, like the other party could then come in and pass more of their legislation. And I always say, yes, like that is how a democracy is supposed to work. People are supposed to see what the parties do. That becomes information in how they think about their vote in the next election.
Yes.
Then they use that information to make another vote, right? Like you'll often hear Democrats say, you know, Republicans could have repealed Obamacare, you know. Well, number one, Republicans were trying to repeal Obamacare through budget reconciliation with 50 votes anyway. So if they had done that, that, you know, like getting rid of the filibuster would not have protected Obamacare. But also if Republicans had repealed Obamacare, people would have been angry and Republicans would have suffered for that electorally and Democrats might have put it back or, you know, who knows. That process of legislating and even of undoing legislation is how the system is meant to work.
Yes.
This process of stasis and not being able to do anything in the first place, in my view, is not a good way to translate the public will into a political process.
Right. This environment where the minority party just tries to destroy the majority of party's ability to do anything, to appear to be productive. It creates so much disillusionment and resentment and bitterness and all the rest. People just check out of politics, right?
Yeah.
And so you're saying the filibuster is the best way to change that. Next, let's talk about partisan gerrymandering. First of all, what the heck is that? Why is this such a big issue?
So this is like the simplest argument in the world. What is happening right now is in many states, though not all, parties draw the districts, the congressional districts in this case. And in doing that, they do very complicated things using very complicated computer algorithms to try to massively benefit their side. So you have places like Wisconsin and others where the districts have been drawn such that even if the out-of-power party won a very large majority of votes, it would not win a majority of seats. It depends on like sort of like how you split up the kind of voters who, with very high levels of precision, we know how they will vote. So you can split them up into a lot of different districts and give your side a big advantage, not because you got more votes, but because the lines were drawn in, to your benefit. This is an inversion of how politics is supposed to work. Politicians are not supposed to choose their voters. Voters are supposed to choose their politicians. Partisan gerrymandering is just fundamentally deeply not just unfair, but is a corruption. It is a kind of a sickness of the system, and it should be done away with.
Is it fair to say both sides do it whenever they have the power? Is there one side that's more effective about it, more corrupt? How do we describe this?
Both sides do it sometimes. I mean, different states are different. What's been happening in recent years is you've had a number of Democratic states like California moving away from partisan gerrymandering because Democrats are more upset about it. There are Democratic states that do gerrymander quite aggressively. Overall, right now, Republicans are being more aggressive and are not moving away from the practice. But both sides do it. Neither side should do it.
Number four on your list is open primaries. This is a system where all candidates for an office are listed on a ballot, regardless of party. And some states, like California, already use a version of this system. What's wrong with the current primary system elsewhere, and how would this change make it better?
Yeah, so noting that there are a couple different ways you can imagine open primaries working, because there are also places where what you can do is just vote in either side's primary. California has this thing called the jungle primary, where, as you say, like the top two vote-getters, whoever they are, end up in the election. So sometimes you have two Democrats running against each other in the general election. The basic insight here is that, particularly in the past however many decades, 4 or 5 decades, the number of Americans who do not belong to a political party has skyrocketed. Neither party is highly popular. A lot of people are independents. But the decision, we are still a political system structured around parties. And so the decision of who will be on the ballot in November or whenever the general election is for a given election is up to the people who vote in primaries. The people who vote in primaries are weird. They are a small fraction of the electorate, right? Fewer people vote in primary elections than general elections. But in many ways, it is the most important vote that is taken because it structures the choices for everybody in the general election. So it just should not be that way, right? The power to decide who is on the ballot when everybody votes should not be arrogated or held to a small fraction of the total voting pool. Open primaries, again, there are different ways of structuring them. I'm open to a number of different ways of structuring them, but open primaries help to solve that problem.
I take your point about the small number of people that are participating in primaries, and I want to go a little further on it. What are the ways to get more casual political consumers involved, people that right now don't vote at all? Are there other proposals or other ways to bring them in, to make them feel like the system works for them?
There are different things you can do to make voting easier, right? Automatic voter registration is one of them. I mean, you can go all the way to where some countries like Australia and Brazil go, which is compulsory voting, where you have to vote or you pay a fine. You can make voting both on primaries and general elections a holiday, right? If voting day was a day off from work, more people would vote. They would have more time to vote. Yeah, we can make it a weekend thing. The other thing I would say is that on some level, voting is always going to be, unless you make it compulsory, it's always going to be structured a little bit by enthusiasm. So it's always going to be a somewhat non-representative group, but you can make it more and less non-representative. And, you know, take a place like Texas or Wyoming or, for that matter, California. You don't want to have a situation in these places where you know who is going to win at the end of the day. And so even though you have a huge number of people in the other party, it's not like there are no Democrats in Texas or no Republicans in California, but they have very little say over, you know, who kind of ends up as a nominee and as such, then who ends up as the person actually in power. But, you know, if you imagine being a Democrat in Texas, you know, you don't want to be a Republican because you're not a Republican. But maybe it actually is very important to you who wins a Republican primary because they're probably going to win. And so maybe you want to be voting in the Republican primary. Now, you could say from the Republican Party's perspective, or, you know, flip the example to California, the Democratic Party's perspective, like, that's not fair. That's bad. This is a party decision. It should be up to the party, you know, who's running under our banner. And I do, to be honest, think there's a good argument for that. But I don't think we are getting a good outcome of that. I think that the parties are being pushed too far towards extremism and too far towards ideologues, because the first question, and oftentimes the only question, is whether you can win a vote of your co-partisans. Mm. A good way to think about this that I think people are more familiar with is in New Hampshire, you have the ability of independents to vote on either side.
Right.
And so when you have the New Hampshire primary, in presidential elections, you often have, that's typically a push for more moderate candidates like John McCain in 2000, or that's where Nikki Haley was expected to make a very strong stand in 2024. And that's because of the inclusion of moderates. So in New Hampshire, the candidates have a real reason to appeal to a broader section of the electorate than they do in, say, Iowa or some other places. And I think that's generally been for the good. The closed primaries and the way we have them are just disenfranchising too many people.
The fifth and final idea on your list is about sharply limiting money in politics. This is a big one for so many people. But I also think it's sometimes treated like the atmosphere. You know, I personally think about money in politics like it's just the wind, it's the breeze. Nothing I can do to stop the breeze or the weather. But that's not the case. Like, it wasn't always like this. Money was not always hijacking our politics the way it does today. So can you give us a sense of that? What is the problem and what can be done about it?
Yeah, the basic problem is that the Supreme Court, in a series of decisions, going back to a decision called Buckley v. Valeo, but then more recently the Citizens United decisions, which are a string of decisions actually, has ended up taking an extraordinarily expansive view of money as a form of speech. So what the court basically says is that you can say whatever you want in an election, right? That's core to how we think about elections. People should be free to speak their mind. And money is speech, so you are free to spend as much as you want. Now, we've made it legal to have certain kinds of limits, like limits on how much you can donate to an individual candidate or to an individual political party. But that's actually worse in a weird way, to make spending unlimited, but make the donations to individual, you know, like sort of bounded actors in a broad political system limited. So, you know, if I am a mega donor, I can't just give $5 million to Bernie Sanders or Nikki Haley. But I can create a $5 million dark money super PAC to spend on my behalf, Citizens for a Concerned America or whatever. And like, that's just crazy. Now, the issue is to really change this, and certainly to change in the ways I would like to see a change, where you have, you know, limits on donations, you have public funding. You would have to either change the Constitution or you would have to change the court such that it reinterpreted these rules, right? Which I think there's a good case for doing. Both are very, very difficult. There are smaller things you could do just through passing legislation, like the Disclose Acts, where you couldn't do dark money. But if you want to limit the amount of money rather than just change disclosure around the money, you're doing something constitutionally, either around the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Constitution or the actual wording of the Constitution.
What about people listening who might be thinking, these proposals only stand to help one side get ahead? Republicans might hear some of these proposals and say, this only serves to benefit Democrats. It's not really about making the system better. What do you say to that?
I mean, for almost all of them, I think, in fact, for all of them, it's actually oftentimes not clear who they would help. So a good example of this is abolishing the filibuster. In theory, it should be Republicans who want to do that. And the reason is the Senate, because it is built around states and Republicans do much better in lower population states. Republicans are a very rural coalition. Democrats are a very urban coalition. Mm-hmm. Republicans have a significant advantage at the Senate level. So if Republicans are just acting with a modicum of strategic sense, they should be in charge in the Senate quite a lot. That hasn't really been happening as often as you would think it would be lately, because they keep, through primaries, nominating kind of ridiculous candidates and then losing. But there's no reason it won't, you know, even out in their favor over time. If that's the case, then Republicans, you know, would be able to pass a lot more through the Senate than Democrats can. So it is not at all clear to me that abolishing the filibuster is better for Democrats than it is for Republicans.
Interesting.
You know, and the same for a lot of these proposals. I mean, maybe not the money in politics proposal, but maybe, right? Republicans recently feel the big business has turned towards Democrats.
All I keep hearing is that Biden has more money than Trump for the campaign.
Yep, and Biden has more money than Trump. So maybe Republicans should not be thinking like this is such a good thing for them. I don't actually think Republicans are making like a clear-eyed strategic call on this. I think there's an almost a kind of reflexive, like if Democrats want to do something, they don't want to do it.
We've talked about all five, but of course there are so many others, right? There are so many other proposals for reform, term and or age limits, expanding the House, shortening election cycles, automatic voter registration. How do we create more awareness and enthusiasm for these possibilities? How do we, you know, open people's eyes to these?
I would not say I'm highly optimistic, for one thing. Like, one reason it is so hard to do anything is that you can't pass things. So if you could pass things, then at least the things that don't require a constitutional amendment could pass if the party that prioritized them came into power. In the states where, you know, there's a little bit more movement, you can have ballot initiatives, you do see more things happening. So in states, I think there's a little bit more excitement, energy, possibility.
Interesting.
But it's very hard to pick that up to the national level because the national level is gridlocked.
Mm-hmm.
The constitutional question is just much harder. We have a constitution that is much too difficult now to amend. And because of that, things at that level of structure within the American political system have become functionally unchangeable. I don't think that's good. In general, you don't want structures to become immune to reform, immune to evolution. Right? An organism, or for that matter, an institution that cannot change and evolve is one that is eventually going to break as it becomes unfit for its environment. So, you know, I have worries about that.
I love my 150-year-old house, but it needs renovations.
Exactly. So that's very much how America is, too. Renewal is the work of every generation. We don't get to skip the charge.
What I like about this conversation is it makes me remember that politics is just people. This is just all about people power. And it doesn't have to be the way it is today.
Everything we have here was a decision made by some set of human beings at some point. Different decisions can be made.
Ezra, thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you, Brian.
You can listen to The Ezra Klein Show on Apple Podcasts. You'll find a link to it on our show notes page. This is my final episode hosting Apple News in Conversation, so I want to thank all of you for listening. It's been an honor filling in while Shumita is on maternity leave, and it's been a blast working with the amazing team here. Don't miss Julia Carpenter's episodes in April.